coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware faces an affordable housing crisis, and the new head of the Delaware State Housing Authority says they're seeking solutions despite a lack of resources and funding.
It's incredibly frustrating to have all of this attention on housing, all of this alignment, quite frankly, across the communities, but to not have the resources there to support us.
We sit down with new DSHA Director Matthew Heckles this week. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also delve into avian flu risks in Delaware as migratory birds make their way north this spring, and learn more about scams targeting seniors and how to avoid them. Plus, Arts Playlist previews First Date Ballet's take on a Shakespeare classic. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first date of mine. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware has a new leader tasked with addressing one of the state's most pressing challenges, housing, specifically affordable housing. Matthew Heckles now leads the Delaware State Housing Authority as its director, and he's no stranger to the agency. He previously served as legislative and policy advisor for DSHA, and more recently as the Mid-Atlantic Regional Administrator for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. This week, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee sat down with Heckles to discuss his plans to tackle the state's housing crisis and make housing more affordable and accessible for Delawareans.
The first thing I wanted to ask you was just to kind of give you the floor and see if you wanted to talk about your priorities and goals as the new director.
You know, I always start with how excited I am to work for Governor Meyer and his administration, because in most of the conversations that we have about housing, he starts with the premise that housing is a human right. And that is just a really great place to start to talk about housing. One of my goals is to make sure that DSHA has what it needs to perform at the highest level, that gives us the ability to support our partners in the way that that we need to. And that's a combination of making sure that we have the resources coming to us from the state, from our financing capacities, from the federal government, and that we have the capacity, both human capacity and the infrastructure, the information technology, the policies and procedures that allow us to deploy our resources into the community as efficiently as we can. We're going to work to make sure that we have more resources. That's difficult these days. The federal government is going in a different direction than I would like it to, especially when it comes to housing and community development programming and its capacity. I think that there's an opportunity for the state to step in a lot of instances and fill gaps, but we may have to prioritize how we do that. But at the base of it, we will only be successful if DSHA is a well-run organization. The other thing is that we have such great partners. That's, I think, one of the strengths here in Delaware, is that we have great partners in the nonprofit sector, the development community, at local jurisdictions, our partners in philanthropy, all over the state. There are a lot of people who are looking to support this administration and DSHA and what we're doing for housing for people and families in Delaware. And so we need to get back to making sure that we're all swimming in the same direction. You know, it's just important for us all to get on the same page and make sure that we're all trying to accomplish the goals, but also do it in the way that we know works. And that's a role that I think DSHA has to play moving forward.
I was actually planning on sort of talking about federal funding and how that is going to change the landscape a little later. But since you brought it up, I'll go ahead and just jump there now. You know, HUD recently pulled funding from CLASI's fair housing efforts, which was about, I think it was 4% of their annual budget. So a pretty tough cut. And federal funding has just been in this kind of unreliable state right now with the first few months of the new administration. So can you talk a little bit about how you're planning on navigating that environment with potentially, you know, unreliable funds, and how you'll establish a more stable ground for DSHA?
You know, I think that's the first of many cuts to housing programs that we anticipate. The continuing resolution that passed, was, I think that was just last week or so, made some reductions to housing budgets. But I'm really fearful about what the budget that comes up in the next federal fiscal year that that would take effect on October 1st, and what might be happening as a result of those negotiations. I expect that the federal government, and you know, we've seen it already, right? Is going to be contracting. And that means that there's going to be a larger role for states to play. I think the best case scenario is that we see some of these programs devolve to the state level. That just means that rather than having sort of administrators at the federal level moving that money out into communities, that they might devolve that to the states to do that. I think that that Delaware has to be prepared to take on that role if that is the way that the federal government transforms itself. That would be the best case scenario because that would imply that there are still funds to allocate to families and communities in Delaware. The alternative, the worst alternative, is that those funds are eliminated completely. Then it would be up to the state to try to fill the gaps financially. And in an environment where, you know, that's happening, I would expect that we would see difficult budget times. We are already seeing difficult budget times at the state level as well. And so, you know, in a place, especially in housing, with an administration that wants to do great things, it's incredibly frustrating to have all of this attention on housing, all of this alignment, quite frankly, across the communities. And the people that I've talked to in the few weeks that I've been in this job, to have great alignment on what we need to do and a dedication to accomplishing the goals, but to not have the resources there to support us, that is an incredibly frustrating sort of set of circumstances to be in.
Absolutely. And you sort of hit on another question, so I'll move that way as well. We've received a lot of listener questions about, bolstering assistance to renters, improving their protections, that kind of thing, especially now, with Class C losing some of its funding to protect potentially those same groups. What are your thoughts on that and the state's bandwidth to address assistance and protection of renters?
Yeah, renter protection is really important. You know, long term, I believe that you know, we have a housing supply problem that we have to respond to. And it's pretty simple. You know, it goes back to economics 101. When you have a dislocation of supply and demand, prices go up. And what happens with a lack of supply is that it creates this tremendous downward pressure on the market. And so housing supply is a big thing that we need to undertake in the state. Delaware's already started the work. We just last week wrapped up the meetings of the Affordable Housing Production Task Force, which is looking at increasing the supply of affordable housing and housing overall. There is, I think, some momentum in the legislature and with our local jurisdictions, Sussex County and other jurisdictions that are looking at changing their land use policies so that we can build not just more, but build differently than what we have for the past several decades. Relieving that pressure on the market, investing in affordable housing along with that is the best way for us to move forward. You know, when it comes to renter protections, you know, I think that it's important as we can't just create supply overnight. So we're stuck with the situation that we have now for at least some time. And so it's important for us to make sure that renters are protected. And that's a way of making sure that they don't fall into homelessness. While we fix the big problem of housing supply and affordability, we've got to make sure that people are protected in the meantime.
I wanted to sort of move forward to talk a little bit about how you plan on or how you want to encourage workforce and affordable housing, especially in Sussex County, and then also, in connection to that, how you hope to encourage private entities to invest in or partner with DSHEA to make that happen.
You know, I think that's going to take some real leadership. You know, I think when people push back on density or on land use approvals, it's because of their experience over the last, you know, 50 years. And what has happened is that local jurisdictions have really restricted the types of housing that we can develop. And so the average home size in Delaware these days is somewhere around 2,500 square feet. That house is probably on a half an acre lot. That half acre lot probably used to be a forest or cornfield or something like that, right? And because of its size and because of its lack of density, that home is going to be very, very expensive. And that's what we've created in Delaware for the past several decades. And I understand why people don't want to see more of that. I think it's there's a challenge before us because we both have to make sure people understand why and how we need to develop more housing in Delaware, but also make sure that we don't do it in the way that we have. If we built 50,000 new units of 2,500 square foot homes on half acre lots, there wouldn't be a whole lot of land left in Delaware, and it wouldn't fix our affordability problem because all of those units, because of the economics of home building, those units would be at $600,000 or $700,000 or $800,000. That's not the path forward. We have to find a way to make sure that, yes, we build more, but that we do it smarter and we do it differently than we have for the past several decades. We need more dense communities that have a diversity of housing types, from multifamily apartments to condos to row homes to semi-detached homes. We need places for workers who are, working in our schools and our hospitals. So we need places for people to start families, first-time home buyers, where they can go and buy a home for $250,000 or $300,000. And you don't do that necessarily by making a really expensive home more affordable. You do it by producing affordable homes that have smaller square footage, and are more densely put together. So I think it's got to be an environment where we welcome new creation of new housing, but that we also talk to people about how we're going to do that differently, so that we obtain different results than we have for the past several decades.
For sure. And I have a couple questions right now just about a couple of the methods that that Delaware has put in place so far. So the first is, can you share your thoughts on pallet villages? I know that there was one that opened in Georgetown in 2023 and got a new I think it was a community center that was built late last year. Can you talk a little bit on that and if there are plans to expand that project elsewhere or in Georgetown?
I get asked a lot about sort of pallet villages or tiny homes, and quite frankly, I container homes is another thing that I don't really necessarily care what it looks like or how it's built. I care about the end result, and when I look at the pallet village, I think that it is a way of providing stable housing to people who are homeless. With supportive services. And that's why the community center is actually a really important part of that. You're not only providing the housing, and again, I don't really particularly care if it's in a hotel or if it's a deconstructed hotel in tiny homes or pallet homes sort of spread out over more area. What's important is that it has the supportive services there to make sure that people have what they need to stabilize themselves and their families and move back into permanent housing.
Absolutely. Another method was in late, last year, there were also a couple hundred project-based housing vouchers offered in Kent County. Are there plans to continue that or create more vouchers?
Project-based vouchers is a really effective way of making sure that you not only support the family through rent subsidy, but also the project more broadly. I'm never sure if it's 20 or 25% of their total voucher allocation from HUD for project-basing those vouchers. We'll look into whether or not we have more capacity under that rule from HUD. Again, a lot of headwinds before us here, but the good thing I still I said before and I'll say it again, I'm an optimist. I think one of the good things is that there's a lot of attention on this, and that people, including the governor, have put housing and housing affordability and the cost of living at the very top of their list of priorities.
Thanks to Delaware State Housing Authority Director Matthew Heckles and our Abigail Lee for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. Bird flu continues to spread across the country, and it's raising concerns in the first state. A University of Delaware wildlife ecology professor weighs in on the risks and the state's response. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Across the country, the highly pathogenic avian influenza, or bird flu, continues to spread. Bird flu isn't new, but experts say the virus is evolving and fear it's here to stay long term. That's a particular concern in Delaware, where poultry is a cornerstone of the state's agricultural economy, and cases have already been reported in both commercial and backyard flocks. As migratory waterfowl like ducks and geese make their way north this season, there are growing concerns they could also carry the virus even further. Delaware Public Media's Colin McKinnon spoke this week with University of Delaware Professor of Wildlife Ecology Chris Williams about bird flu in the first state and what's being done to mitigate its spread.
Delaware's regional outbreak of bird flu started in wild snow geese at Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge just before the new year in Sussex. So before we get to the current state of things here in the first state, can you walk us through, in layman's terms, what exactly bird flu is and why this strain is more concerning than other cases in recent years?
Yeah, so avian influenza was established or first found in Asia, and it's gone through different iterations over time. And so we've had this outbreak over the last handful of years. It goes through ups and downs. It's primarily respiratory disease that infects, you know, primarily birds, starts with waterfowl, can move into the poultry industry, which is our biggest concern. But there are additional occurrences in multiple species, but birds are our biggest worry.
You touched on this a bit, but I know a lot of our listeners out there, you know, are wondering how susceptible, you know, their own pets are to contracting bird flu, and maybe what the likelihood that they themselves can get bird flu. The strain has already reportedly spread to other species, including dairy cattle, as well as human farm workers in other states. But, you know, as you alluded to, the CDC does say the risk to humans remains low. It is a rarity among rarities. So, but you know, what about that? What can you tell us about, you know, just unpack that a little bit more about how bird flu spreads?
It is true that bird flu is popping up in multiple species. And there's always concerns that there could be variants that form that could become more virulent for multiple species. But for right now, it really is primarily a bird-focused flu. While there are a few cases of humans, or say our pets, like our dogs, have contracted, it's very, very rare. And so it's not overly a large concern for us. And so the biggest concern that we have really is about transmission between waterfowl and the poultry industry.
Well, here in Delaware, cases of bird flu, and again, you noted this, the poultry industry is our big economic cornerstone here in Delaware, but cases of bird flu have been reported in both commercial and backyard poultry flocks. And in case you didn't know, Delaware is situated along the Atlantic Flyway and experiences a very high influx of migrating waterfowl like geese and ducks who are currently on the move. So overall, how would you assess that, you know, this current state of bird flu in Delaware beyond what you've said already? And, you know, how worried should we be about, you know, waterfowl potentially spreading the virus and making all of this that much worse?
Yeah, you know, the bird flu is definitely centered in waterfowl. That's its primary area that it starts. And it shows up in a lot of different species, but even amongst all the different ducks and geese, some are more virulent than others. So we're especially worried about geese as our first step. And so the two big geese that we think of for the most part in the mid-Atlantic are Canada geese and snow geese, greater snow geese. And so the thing that is especially concerning for geese is that they are, number one, you'll often see them in really large flocks, so that those populations or those individuals are much more compact, and it's much easier for the disease to transmit amongst them. The other thing that's worrisome for geese is they're herbivores, and so they're eating grass. And so, especially, there is that possibility that we are intersecting large populations of geese with our poultry houses or other forms of agriculture. For a lot of duck species, we're seeing cases of avian influenza pop up in them. But since they are usually in less dense numbers and they're oftentimes more out in, say, marshes, then the chance for that transmission to our poultry industry is much less. So geese are our primary focus right now.
I was going to save this question until, a little later, but let's say I'm walking around my neighborhood later and I come across a flock of geese, whether they're snow geese or Canada geese. My concern level should be, where exactly? Just still pretty low.
Yeah, I mean, I think there should always be caution, since we know that there are higher numbers in the geese. I think one thing that we are seeing higher numbers, especially in snow geese that are going to be out more in the wild, versus the Canada geese that we've got surrounding our neighborhoods or our grocery store parking lots, things like that. And so while they may feel, all those Canada geese may feel a little dense as we're trying to walk around, it's nothing like the thousands of snow geese that might be moving out in the landscape wildly. I think everyone should have caution when it comes to geese, especially if they're, say, walking in a park and they see a dead goose or they see a goose that looks sick. Just avoid it. It probably doesn't help or doesn't hurt to submit a notice to the local authorities just to say that there is a goose so it can be picked up by Fish and Wildlife and actually tested for avian influenza. But for the most part, I think, everyday travel should be relatively okay.
Right, yeah, maybe don't mingle with the geese. I another question I was gonna save till later though, but as far as what a sick goose looks like or other species that do like poultry that would contract avian influenza, what signs or symptoms, what does it look like? How does it present?
So I would say, for the most part, it sort of a bird is going to act a little bit like maybe any of us that might come down with, a really bad cold or flu. So it's going to be sluggish, or sort of moving erratically, and so just that's sort of the key signs. Something that just sort of looks abnormal in the way that they're behaving.
Yeah. I'm also curious just for your thoughts on something else here. In a story today done by one of our reporters, Abigail Lee, the spokesman for the Delmarva Chicken Association, James Fisher, he noted a distinction between egg-laying chicken farms and those producing chickens for food. What do you make of that as far as if there are different concerns for different farms and more of a vulnerability with egg farms?
At least in my impression, I think it's an equal worry. But if avian influenza gets into a poultry operation, the key issue is that for those poultry operations, they often need to cull the herd and remove all of those birds just in case. So if there is an individual bird that is identified as sick, then oftentimes that whole flock needs to be removed, destroyed. And so there's two directions that goes. If it's for meat, certainly we're losing all of those birds and that economy that relates to those pounds of poultry. But at the same time, the same impact occurs on eggs, and this is why we're seeing the egg prices also shoot up. Because for flocks that need to be removed, even as egg layers, then that just means less eggs that are being put into the marketplace. So I think it's an equal concern across the board.
You also mentioned, culling the herd and whatnot. I know it was just reported that Georgie Cartanza, a chicken farmer and the poultry extension agent for the University of Delaware's Cooperative Extension Program, she did share today that chickens had to be put down at her farm, and now the farm is under strict quarantine after being hit by the bird flu. So this is an ongoing issue. News is coming up, cropping up every single day. Chris, what concerns then, and I've used that word more than I'd like to in this conversation because it isn't, this isn't something to necessarily, overreact, to, but it is concerning. So what concerns you the most about the current situation then in this strain of bird flu in Delaware? Is it the I've seen the word unpredictable used around this strain. What concerns you around that?
Yeah, I think one of the things, I mean, there's two sides of it. We worry greatly about any wildlife disease, zoonotic, we call them, that can transfer into the domestic animal industry. And so that hurts the bottom line for farmers on any given day of the week. But the other issue that worries us is just sort of what genetic variations can occur. As the disease is allowed to spread, and it becomes more prevalent, there is the possibility for these genetic variants to just naturally occur. That's always happening in nature. And so it ultimately is important that we have a great deal of caution. And I think that's the perspective that everyone has had and acted very well through these last several years, these ebbs and flows of avian influenza outbreaks, that we take it seriously.
What can we do as we wrap up then? What can we do as individuals on this, boots on the ground level? What can we do to reduce this risk of making all of this worse?
It's really hard. There's no good answers to that. It is sort of the nature of zoonotic diseases. And the large term issue simply is that as the human population is just getting larger and larger, and we continue to expand our own footprint into habitats that animals once more freely occupied, you're just going to have more interactions with wildlife diseases. And there's really not much we can do about that.
Thanks to UD Professor of Wildlife Ecology, Chris Williams, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, with financial fraud and scams targeting seniors on the rise, we take a closer look at efforts to curb elder fraud and how to better protect this vulnerable population. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. From phishing texts to imposter scams, fraud targeting seniors is rising. Reported financial losses among older adults are growing, with the Federal Trade Commission estimating billions of dollars stolen in 2023 alone, the latest year with available data. AARP Fraud Ambassador Paul Greenwood visited Delaware this week to meet with law enforcement, the FBI, and specialists in the field as part of an AARP-organized discussion. Greenwood was the lead prosecutor of the Elder Abuse Protection Unit in the San Diego District Attorney's Office for 22 years, prosecuting hundreds of felony cases involving physical, sexual, emotional, and financial abuse against seniors. And this week he joined Delaware Public Media's Joey Arzari to talk about efforts to curb elder fraud and how we can better protect vulnerable seniors.
Fraud targeting seniors, it's nothing new, but we're seeing it happen at increasingly higher rates. Why is that, and what exactly is going on?
Yes. I think several reasons. One of them, of course, is just simple demographics. More and more people are becoming older adults. They say that every day in America, 10,000 people turn age of 65. So the database is growing, and the number of reports are coming in much quicker and much better than when I first started out prosecuting these cases back in 1996. And I think we've learned a lot of lessons in the last 25, 30 years about these cases. So for those reasons, and unfortunately, because there are so many different ways now that the predators can take advantage of older adults, the number of ways to defraud older adults is increasing.
And when we say fraud in this context, what kind of fraud are we talking about? This is more than just financial, right?
Well, it covers a whole variety of theft type cases. And it starts with family members. One of the most prevalent suspects that I prosecuted in my 22 years of doing these kind of cases was the son, the adult son living off his widowed mother. lazy, unemployed, drug, alcohol, or gambling addicted, stealing from his mother. Another type of fraudster was the caregiver coming in and stealing the jewelry and the credit card. Or professional thieves. We've had attorneys steal from older adults, realtors, even members of the clergy. I mean, the list goes on. And when, you know, when I talk to people about fraud from older adults, they say, oh, I know what you mean, internet scams. I said, well, yeah, that's part of it. But there's so much more multi-leveled type of cases here.
Well, as this growing issue of senior fraud has evolved over the years, how else are fraudsters targeting older adults in new ways?
Well, they've realized, and I think especially since COVID hit, that older adults are becoming less intimidated by the internet. For many, during COVID, it was their lifeline. So an email was really the highlight of their day. And obviously, more and more older adults are getting more accustomed to having a smartphone on their fingertips, no longer just the landline, but they have a smartphone carrying with them at all times. That in itself has given opportunities to the scams artists to take advantage. So for example, many of these frauds are conducted where the fraudster is actually in the purse or in the pocket of the victim, accompanying them to the bank or the credit union and coaching them on how to put the cash that has just been withdrawn from the bank or the credit union into a cryptocurrency ATM machine. You couldn't do that with a landline in the past, but now the fraudsters have think this is a perfect opportunity to accompany the victim and to make sure that the victim follows through with getting the money.
When we look at Delaware specifically, is there anything about this state and its makeup that makes its seniors more susceptible to fraud, or is everyone essentially in the same boat?
It's a great question, and I don't think that any state should be singled out as being different from any other. There are obviously factors that impact upon a state. For example, a state like Montana or Wyoming is more rural. Maybe older adults there are less accessible to resources. Whereas Delaware, being a little more tight-knit community, a smaller community, what I do say is that the smaller the state, the more opportunity there is for the professionals to connect with one another, to work more cohesively with one another, and to form a commitment with one another to aggressively combat these fraudsters. And so that's why I'm looking forward to Friday's event at the University of Delaware to enable us to really try to rally the troops and get a commitment that we work together much more seamlessly to identify these fraudsters and hold them accountable.
But that's a perfect segue. You are in town this week for that AARP organized discussion on fraud. Now, a big part of that event will be addressing the issue and how seniors can better protect themselves. What role do you think AARP plays in raising awareness and combating elder fraud?
You know, I've been so privileged to work with AARP since my retirement from the prosecutor's office in various ways. There's certainly an emphasis placed on educating the consumer, and that's an important role that AARP does very effectively through their magazine and the regular emails, the fraud alerts. They also do a great job of providing a listening tool for their consumers and even folks who are not members of AARP. There's a Fraud Watch network that has trained telephone volunteers who will listen to victims who've been defrauded. And AARP have also done a great job on teaching all of us how we address victims and what words we use so that we don't actually try to almost blame the victim for being in this predicament. And then finally, Joe, AARP have taken a position to reach out to law enforcement and to other prosecutorial agencies to offer their resources to bring, as we are going to do on Friday, all these agencies together. You know, I've been to several elder justice conferences where professional agencies have had their booths, right? They've set up Department of Justice, Attorney General, the Contractor State Board, whoever it is, postal inspectors, and yet they're not talking to one another and they don't know one another. And what we're trying to do is encourage all these agencies to get to know one another and share intelligence with one another across the board. And that's what excites me, and that's what makes me so proud of the work that AARP is doing.
So as these fraud cases and financial losses among seniors continue to rise, what more would you like to see done?
I would like to see more, first of all, funding for agencies to go after this problem. I'd like to see more recognition from our administration, both federally and statewide, that this is a very vicious crime that can impact older adults in so many different ways, not just financially. It can affect them through mental health. It can affect them through depression, loneliness, through actually thinking about taking their own lives. And I really would like to see more emphasis on a multidisciplinary approach across the board, state by state, sharing information with one another. And we shouldn't just be concentrating on what we call the violent crimes. We should be making sure that elder fraud is up there as one of the most challenging and most important criminal justice issues that we need to be facing.
So as we wrap up, for seniors and elders themselves, what can they do individually and how can they better protect themselves from fraudsters and scams?
Yes, very important. And so this really needs to be addressed not only by the older adults themselves, but by the adult children of the older adults who need to understand that their parents are at great risk of becoming the next victim through a phone call, through an email, through a text on the smartphone. And so it is always to say, don't ever give out any information about yourself. Don't ever trust anybody who contacts you pretending to be part of the Social Security Administration, part of Medicare, part of the local police department, whoever it is. Don't immediately assume that they are who they say they are, even if they say they give you a badge over the phone or over an email. Always verify. And always, always, before you ever do anything of a financial transaction, always contact your own family. Always contact your own professional advisor. Get somebody else, a set of eyes to look at this situation. Nothing is so urgent that it needs you to respond without telling anybody else.
Thanks to AARP Fraud Ambassador Paul Greenwood and our Joey Rosari for joining us on The Green this week. And we finish out The Green next with Arts Playlist, where we head to the Grand in Wilmington for a preview of the First Ape Ballet Theater's fresh take on Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream is a story of love, mischief, and magic, and soon it will come to life on stage in a whole new way. First Ape Ballet Theatre is bringing this classic tale to the Grand in Wilmington on April 5th and 6th, blending elegant choreography with a fresh score, including a new Ukrainian-themed twist inspired by local choreographer Zachary Kapelik's cultural heritage. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny caught up with Kapelik for more on his vision for A Midsummer Night's Dream and what audiences can expect.
Tell me a little bit about this production and your vision for it.
Yeah, so Pasha asked me to do a brand new Midsummer Night's Dream for the company. We've been talking about this for like over a year now, I think. And when he initially approached me about it, I immediately knew that I didn't want to do the typical Midsummer. I didn't want to use the original score, the Mendelssohn score. So I thought about ways that I could use something different. And eventually it got me to thinking that there were some really strong parallels between the Midsummer Night's Dream story and very traditional Ukrainian rituals for Midsummer, essentially. I'm Ukrainian American by heritage. I'm third generation Ukrainian American. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to kind of thread some of those parallels into the Midsummer story. So essentially what I've done is I took certain aspects of, it's called Ivan Kupalo, the actual evening of Midsummer celebration in Ukraine. And I took some of the aspects of rituals that happened during that and weave them throughout the ballet.
What does that look like on stage?
There's a lot of influence with Ukrainian folklore. Water is a big thing. So we have a very minimal set design. There are four large tables that get kind of wheeled throughout the stage during the production. They help to kind of separate the stage into different scenes. And at times they can go up, they're upturned to be on their sides, which kind of forms a river. So there's aspects of a river running through the entire production because water is it's an important kind of element of those Ivan Kupalo rituals, as well as floral wreaths. A lot of young ladies will wreathe flowers into like a crown, and then you'll set it adrift in the river in the hopes that, you know, someone, some lucky guy or girl will pick it up and you'll find your, you know, your soulmate. And I'm working with a costume designer who is also taking a lot of influence from traditional Ukrainian embroidery and weaving that throughout the costume design as well. So there'll be little snippets of things where if you were Ukrainian and you're sitting in the audience and you knew, you'd be able to pick it up pretty quickly.
Tell me a little bit about your background and how you got to this point.
Well, I started dancing at a very young age. When I began dancing, it was in traditional Ukrainian folk dance. All of my family, for the last like three generations, essentially, they've all been Ukrainian folk dancers. So that's how I started when I was about 3 years old. And then I moved into ballet and loved it, stuck with it, went to school eventually for it in Pittsburgh, where I grew up. And after graduating, I got a job with a company in Philadelphia called Ballet X. I spent almost 10 years there, and I retired from the company in 2022. And when I retired, I started to segue into choreography and teaching, and I got connected to Pasha and Christina at First State pretty early on after leaving Ballet X. In fact, I think I actually choreographed my first piece for them while I was still dancing with Ballet X. So we've had a very fruitful relationship, I would say, over the last like 3 years. I've done a lot of work for them, and I feel like I've gained their trust, which is why they, you know, felt comfortable asking me to do this new production. And it just felt like a very natural fit for me to be able to do it here with First State.
You mentioned that you wanted to stay away from the original Mendelssohn score. What went into choosing music, and what did you finally choose?
When I made the decision not to use the Mendelssohn score, I spent some time kind of brainstorming, okay, if I'm not going to use it, what am I going to do? And eventually I decided, you know, okay, if I'm going to bring these Ukrainian influences into the show, why don't I try to find music that is by Ukrainian classical composers of the last couple centuries? I compiled a score. It's mostly, in fact, I think it's entirely two specific Ukrainian composers from the 1900s, essentially. And yeah, it's about 50 or so minutes of music. That's kind of a amalgamation of the two of them that I strung together.
I wonder if you could tell me what your creative process is like, how you go from, okay, I'm going to choreograph this to a complete finished idea.
Oh, that's a great question. I'm still figuring that out myself. I typically like to go, this is my first full-length ballet. The longest thing I've done up until this point was maybe like 22, 23 minutes. So to do a two-act ballet felt like a very different beast. So I wasn't able to approach it necessarily in the same way that I would with a shorter, you know, more concise work. So for this particular process, I actually wrote like a libretto so that I had a very clear idea of the plot line and what needed to happen when. And I reference it a lot when I'm choreographing just to make sure that I'm sticking to the story that we're supposed to tell. But when I'm actually in the studio with the dancers, we jump around a lot. We don't necessarily go in order. I'll work on one scene from the second act and then I'll jump to the first act, and eventually everything will come together into one full picture.
I wonder if there are particular lessons that you learned as a dancer that you've taken with you into the world of being a choreographer.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Being a dancer, especially being a dancer at Ballet X has a very large emphasis on doing new work. So I think in the 10 years, 9 years that I was there, I probably worked with at least 50 plus different choreographers in that time. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot about things that work well. I learned a lot about things that don't work well. And I try to keep all of that information in mind when I'm working with dancers, knowing full well that it wasn't that long ago that I was in their position. So trying to be mindful and respectful of their work and their contribution to what we're doing, while also, you know, at the same time, understanding that I'm the person that's kind of orchestrating it all. So trying to find that balance between being the person in the front of the room, but also feeling approachable enough for the dancers to be able to contribute.
When we think about Shakespeare, it's primarily through a textual lens, the power of his language, the wordplay, the writing, and it seems to me that it's a challenge to convey that story without being able to lean on the text. And I wonder how you approach that.
Well, luckily, I'm not the first to do it. So I have a lot of reference that I can use. George Balanchine is probably the most famous version of the ballet that has been put on stage. So I have used that particular production as a nice reference point on how to further the plot without, like you said, using any words. I think that's kind of what's magical about story ballets, is that you have to be creative in the ways that you get a very particular point across. And in the case of Midsummer, the plot is pretty convoluted. There's a lot going on. So it's kind of fun to figure out ways to convey those very convoluted plot lines without any words. And I rely on the dancers a lot, honestly, to come up with ideas as well on how to elucidate certain things without speaking.
What do you hope audiences will take away from this performance?
Honestly, I just hope that they enjoy it. I hope that they're entertained by it. As a Ukrainian American who's still quite involved culturally with Ukrainian culture, I also hope that maybe, you know, it sparks an interest in something in that regard. Especially, I think I've even discovered some beautiful, beautiful music from these Ukrainian composers. You know, maybe an audience member will be like, wow, that's gorgeous, and want to leave and research and, you know, hear more.
Thanks to local choreographer Zachary Kapelik and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. First State Ballet Theater is performing Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Grand in Wilmington, April 5th and 6th. Visit the Greens page at DelawarePublic.org for more information. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to the Greens page on our website. You can also sign up for a weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee, Joe Irizarry, Martin Matheny, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. for all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.